Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, Chris, we just watched the season finale of The White Lotus Season 2.
I can't believe it. I can't believe they did that to our girl, Tanya.
Tanya's dead. Oh, my God. There's so much to talk about.
There's so much. Me and Lucia inherited the earth and so much money.
Someone's going to win a prize, so let's get into it.
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Chris Murphy.
And I'm Richard Lawson. We're here to discuss the seventh and final episode of the HBO series The White Lotus, Arrivederci. Well, the final episode of season two.
Yes.
I think there's going to be more.
There'll be more in store.
And what a finale it was, Chris. Our beloved Tanya perished in the Ionian Sea.
By her own hands.
In a very operatic way. And she took down a cabal of nefarious gays, which is something you and I have been trying to do for years now.
The gays were trying to murder her as they've been trying to murder us.
Harper and Ethan reconnect as only one can in a fancy hotel room in Sicily. And the DeGrassos, well, they return to some old habits, but maybe hopefully generationally have evolved a little bit. And of course, me and Lucia,
yeah,
happy ending.
Our girls get the happy endings. We're so happy for them. Also, we have two conversations to share with you this week. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with series creator Mike White, where we'll get into whatever he can tell us about season three. And I hope he tells us as much as possible, because I need to know what's going to happen, and share some of our own hopes for where The White Lotus is headed from here. But first, later in this episode, we'll talk to Megan Fahey about Daphne's one final moment of wisdom and what she and Ethan got up to on that old island castle.
All right, Chris, it's time to attend to the most important business of today, which is
of the year.
Really, once and for all, settling who wins the White Lotus still watching Aperol Spritz prize of accurately predicting who was dead at the end of the season.
And given the fact that neither of us came really anywhere close.
Well, I think you should give yourself a little credit because you are, in fact, the winner. Way back in episode one of this podcast, you predicted that Tanya would die.
This is true. This is true. And the real ones who've been listening since the beginning know that I did. I did say Tanya would die. And did I change my mind every episode since then? Of course. But I did predict that Tanya would die. And this is a lesson in sticking with your gut and trusting your first instinct. It's always correct.
It's also a lesson in dynamic storytelling, because we had to have this sort of like, no, we laid the breadcrumbs all along. You just had to pay attention to the clues.
Yeah.
So well done, Chris.
Thank you. I know you really wanted that Aperol Spritz,
yeah,
Richard,
well,
so I'm so sorry.
I'll somehow deal without it. All right, Chris, it's the time. I'm going to pour you your prize, your delicious smelling.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
Are you ready?
Monday at 10 a.m.?
Ooh, yum.
That's when I want an Aperol Spritz.
And now to make it a Spagliato. There
wow.
we go.
Transported to the... I feel like I'm in the White Lotus right now.
Cheers. I'm going to just stick with my water.
Cheers.
Congratulations, Chris.
I'd like to thank the Academy.
So, Chris, there's a lot to talk about, as we said. Let's save the big bit for last, the shootout on the boat.
The Godfather-esque shootout.
And instead start with what I don't think anyone thought was going to be kind of a happy ending with these two couples who hate each other.
Which we should have realized, and I feel sort of silly. I feel really silly about a lot of the predictions, a lot of the things that I've said on this podcast, though I stand by everything. But Mike White, given last season what happened with Alexandra Daddario and Jake Lacy's character, they get their, you know, sort of unhappy, happy ending. Mm-hmm. It makes sense that the sort of the avatars of that couple, the rich, privileged couple who, you know, sort of go on vacation, they often leave vacation fine.
Yeah, right.
They usually end up leaving just as fine, if not better in some cases, than they started. So, yeah, I guess in my head, in my fantasy, I wanted, you know, Aubrey Plaza to murder Cameron
right,
and Ethan.
Yeah.
But what was way more likely to happen and way more realistic is that they, you know, they leave the vacation, you know, fine.
They leave it fine, or maybe even better in the case of Ethan and Harper.
Yeah.
You know, it's unclear whether Ethan went to that little island and had a thing with Daphne
unclear?
But, well, I don't know. I don't, maybe she just talked to him. I don't know. Maybe they did whatever. But I think, like, kind of, you know, and White was, you know, playing with our expectations, this confrontation in the water between Ethan and Cameron. Oh, was one was drowning the other. Then they flip-flopped. And then the other was drowning him. And then some random guy comes up and breaks it up. And Cameron kind of laughs at the end. And it's like, of course, that doesn't happen to these people. That's not that they get in their little fight and then they kind of pretend
and they brush
it didn't
it
happen.
Off, and then they have dinner together that night, which is so insane.
And like Ethan and Harper didn't seem thrilled about that. But by the end, I'm sure they were like, yeah, we'll pick up our glasses and do a toast. We're not going to walk away, you know, rude or whatever.
Yeah, to the Maldives next year in the Maldives.
So I think, I mean, it's like it sounds sort of simple or cliche. And I'm not, that's not a criticism of White's writing. I think he's kind of driving us toward that. It's like Harper and Ethan just need a little adventure, a little danger, a little something.
Sex, really, sex is sort
to,
of...
Yeah, something to lead them to that sex, and then now we see them content in the airport. And, you know, in terms of Cameron and Daphne, we're going to be speaking to Megan Fahey later, but, like, I don't think that's a happy ending exactly, but it's a status quo ending, at least.
I mean, there's a lot more ambiguity with the Cameron-Daphne ending, and with, I would say, Daphne's character. We never got, like, a clear answer about the kids, if they're Cameron's, if they're not. I mean, I think we can choose to believe what we choose to believe in that situation. And then Daphne sort of emerges as maybe the wisest person, the sort of sage.
The sort of poet-philosopher of the... the season.
Yeah, in her speech to Ethan on the beach about how we never really know anyone. We can spend all day with people, with somebody and not really know them. And so it might be, and I don't know if you think this is the thesis of the show or if there is some grand thesis that connects the entire show, but we have to do what we have to do to not be a victim of life.
Right, right.
That seems to be Mike White's. And if that means having sex with your Yale roommate's wife on an island... And then that gets you going to have sex with your own wife and like go at it. That's what I took away potentially.
And I think some viewers certainly would understandably be frustrated by some of the ambiguity in this storyline where we don't know for sure what happened with Harper and Cameron. We
or
don't know
Daphne
what happened
and
with
Ethan.
Daphne and Ethan. But in that little speech, well, not so little speech in a way, you know, Daphne is saying like, there are gaps to fill. Like you don't know everything, and you have to either fill that with trust or with contentment or something.
Yeah.
You can fill it with bad things. But like that, you know, I think she's basically telling not only herself and Ethan and but also the audience, like, you know, not everything is going to be met with like some sort of satisfying truth.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean,
or closure.
Does it even matter? Like at the end of the day, if Harper and Cameron had sex or Daphne and Ethan had sex, if they're leaving and Harper and Ethan are in a better place, does it even really matter?
Right.
It seems to be sort of the ethos or the what I took away from it, which is a very mature and evolved way to sort of think about relationships and life. You know, it's sort of the antithesis of jealousy.
It's sort of fatalist in her circumstances, I think, just from like, because it's like, that's a bad marriage in a way. Although, who am I to judge if it works for them?
And it seems that Harper and Ethan taking, you know, a page out of Cameron and Daphne's book sort of helped.
Yeah. Well, so I think it's a complicated, I think it's a little cynical. I think it's a little not cynical, like not exactly optimistic, but And I think one thing to kind of link the second season back to the first, where, you know, the first season was a lot about class and money and stuff, and this was about that too, but mostly more about sex and jealousy and all those things, is that, like, they're at, the four of them is at the airport. They're not sitting with each other.
Yes, that's very important.
But, like, they're all going home rich. I think that Cameron and Daphne aren't having the money problems we thought they were. Yeah. Like, I think Cameron definitely wants that some of Ethan's money invested with him.
100%.
But, like, I don't think that they're hiding a secret poverty or anything.
Yeah, I think our sort of theory, first of many theories that we're going to debunk that were not true that we came up with, that Cameron and Daphne had all these money problems, or that they were some grand schemers or some master planners trying to destroy Harper and Ethan. I don't think that's true. I mean, in this episode, Cameron sort of came across more sort of Trumpy, to use a word, you know, when he's sitting at lunch and he's talking about how, like, it's okay to throw yogurt at your assistant. And then Harper just finally says, "You're an idiot." What we've all been thinking, what we've all been wanting to say, is like, oh, he's simpler than I think we gave him credit for. I think he's pretty simple. And I think Daphne, I do want to go back to Daphne for 1 second, because she's the only person, and back to our survivor metaphor, which I think she wins survivor, she would have won survivor 100%. She's the only person who can process information in real time and make a decision that makes the most sense for herself.
Which you see in probably the season's most proverbial piece of acting, which we'll talk to Megan about.
Yes.
This series of looks when Ethan says, "I think something might have happened between her," and she looks away, she looks at the other. I think of Catherine O'Hara Waiting for Guffman. I want to do that kind of acting where you don't look at when you don't look at them, your eyes are open. When you look at them, your eyes are closed.
Yes, it's brilliant.
But that she's figuring out on the fly. She's giving herself a little bit of time to be like, okay, how do I think? What do I think about this? How am I going to process it? And how am I going to show that reaction outwardly?
Yes. And she's taking in the hurt of the situation of, you know, Harper and Cameron, if that happened. And then she's fixing the problem in real time.
Yeah.
And conveying that to the audience beautifully. It was, it's so good.
And I think because we don't see exactly what that fix was, what exactly that little trip to the island was.
Yeah.
It lets us know about all of her secrets, that, like, in a marriage like that, one observe from the outside, the assumption is, because of gender roles or whatever, is that Cameron's the one with all the secrets. He's the one with the mistress in town. Yeah. He's the blah, 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 blah. But, like, she has secrets too.
Yeah.
And she's alluded to those to Harper when they're in Noto and all that stuff. So I think, you know, I was, because Megan Fahey's so good, I was maybe hoping for something bigger for her at the end. But actually, I think that, like you said, she kind of becomes, in a way, the thematic centerpiece of the season, just in those two short scenes.
Yeah, I mean, I also wanted something. I wanted a big Daphne. I mean, I said this last week. I wanted Daphne to kill somebody. I wanted a big Daphne Harper showdown, like big scene set piece sort of that Cameron and Ethan got in the water. But that is unrealistic. And I do think, what Mike White does, there are points where he goes sort of big and sort of crazy, but also with these couples, they're always sort of the most grounded in reality and sort of like the actual machinations of what couples, what, you know, heterosexual couples, married couples go through. And so it wasn't really realistic for, you know, Daphne and Harper to have some, like, you know, Ryan Murphy-esque like showdown, slap fight, you know, screaming match, Real Housewives thing that I, you know, part of me would have liked to see. I think what we got from Daphne was so much more complicated, and then also showed just how central and how important she was to the series.
Right.
As sort of the beating heart of, like, oh, this is how you win, for lack of a better term.
And then all Harper and Ethan did, other than have sex with each other, was they broke the statue that is a symbol in Sicily of
the curse
of,
had been
of murderous jealousy, and they broke it, and they said, you know, so they're being somewhat insensitive to a culture, I suppose, but also saying, like, we don't have to go down that route.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the end of that.
The curse has been lifted. The spell has been broken. They can have sex. They're having sex. They're connected again. It was really sort of a, considering the option that we came up with last week, where somebody was going to die at the hands of the statue, for the statue to shatter and for them to find each other again, is weirdly optimistic and hopeful. Yeah. And who's to say how long that marriage lasts or whatnot? But it was interesting, having talked to Aubrey Plaza about this, they started in such a bad place and they're leaving in such a better place.
Yeah.
Harper and
one
Ethan.
Hope.
And you know what? And I'm happy for my girl Harper.
Yeah.
I'm happy that she made it. And I hope, I want more Daphne next season, but we'll save that.
We'll table it.
Okay.
All right, Chris, we have dissected the quadrangle of Daphne and Harper and Cameron and Ethan as much as we can. So let's go to one of the sources and hear our chat with Megan Fahey, who plays Daphne. Well, we're so happy to be on the line now with Megan Fahey, who plays Daphne. The great Megan Fahey, I think the pretty great wise Daphne at the end there.
Wise, sage Daphne. Yeah, very lots sage. Of wisdom.
Megan, hello.
Hello, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Of course. We know you're fresh off of a viewing party, so we're sorry to get you up early in the morning to talk about all this.
Oh, no, it's really my pleasure.
So we want to jump right to, I think, the defining scene for us anyway of the episode, which
maybe
is
the series.
Maybe the whole season.
The whole series.
Yeah. This, you're on the beach, and Ethan says, I think something might have happened. And you do so much incredible face acting before you kind of, Daphne collects herself and is just like, well, you know, it's okay. Can you tell us a little bit about filming that? Like, what is in your head as you're kind of gauging Daphne's reaction to Ethan's suspicion?
Well, I think we knew going into it that it was a pretty important moment. So we really took our time with it. I mean, Mike was great in that way anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, I never felt like we rushed through something and didn't really get a chance to sort of sit with it. And that scene is definitely an example of that. I mean, we did it a bunch of different ways, you know? Mm-hmm. So for me, it was really exciting to see how it ended up cutting together because I didn't really know what he was going to choose, which sort of vibe he was maybe going to pick of the ones that we kind of played with. But yeah, I mean, I love that scene for Daphne. I think it's a moment for her where she's, you know, in her own way, being empathetic to Ethan and wanting to make him feel better.
It's so compelling because we see Daphne sort of take in the information and then make a decision. And the decision is sort of ambiguous. She says, we're going on a walk. We're walking. It's not even a question. She says, walk with me. Mm-hmm. What do you think pains Daphne more, the Cameron potential betrayal or the fact that Harper, you know, they're friends at this point? It feels like Daphne thinks that Harper and her are good friends. So,
yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think that, you know, as it applies to Daphne and Cameron, like, she's probably dealt with this. I mean, who knows how many times, yeah. You know, and then we learn in episode 5 that she's got her own thing going too with, mm-hmm. you know, she talks about the trainer and stuff. So it's like, but for it to be Harper, I think probably does play into that first emotion that you do see on her face, which is sadness.
Yeah, heartbreak. It's
yeah. Yeah. But then I think ultimately, you know, we watch her sort of do what she does, which is she makes a very active choice about what she will and will not be affected by and what and how she will allow her life to rule her or not. And then once she's explained that to Ethan, basically, I think she just sees this guy that like looks so broken that she really wants to help him feel better.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, the it was surprising to us, you know, as regular recappers of the show, avid watchers of the show, that like this foursome, they end sort of happy. Do you see it that way? I mean, I think our notion of what a good marriage is subjective. I mean, mm-hmm. maybe this does work for Daphne and Cameron. How do you view it?
That's kind of how I look at it. I mean, I think that the whole sort of storyline there is meant to challenge, you know, what the parameters of what we would call a functioning relationship are. And I think that with Daphne and Cameron, they're trying, and Daphne is trying to teach not just Harper, but also Ethan, that they have other options because that's how she lives. You know, she's kind of like, it doesn't have to be like this. You could get a trainer or like you could take a walk with me to this island and like, you know, who knows what they did there. You know, like I think, and again, I don't think that she does that to make, you know, to get back at Cameron or anything. I genuinely think in her strange way, that's like an empathetic thing that she's doing, the way that she's trying to take care of these people. I think at the end, they do seem kind of happy. I think that, you know, obviously Cameron and Daphne have been through something. Cameron gets the shit kicked out of him. Yeah. Daphne finds a, you know, a dead body. but that moment of her just sort of touching his face and looking at him and then kissing them, kissing is like this really tender moment where, again, you do see the love between these two characters that was there at the beginning. It was there through all of the weird shit that happened, and it's still there at the end when they go home, which is kind of, you know, at the way that they function. And then, of course, the other two have finally had sex, and so they're like basking in the glow of reconnecting to each other physically, which is also so cool to see.
Thanks to Daphne, but which is
basically
you did it. You're an amazing therapist in a way,
and in a weird way, like. Harper and Ethan like become Cameron and Daphne in a way at the end, because it's like this, you know, this sort of secrecy, like infidelity, what happened, and then finally they just like, you know, the tension rises and it serves them.
Well, it goes back to something that Cameron says in an earlier episode, which is like he's talking about how rich folks just have this kind of secret world of immorality or whatever. They kind of do what they want, and in some ways this whole arc for these four characters could be looked at Daphne and Cameron in their way ushering the newly wealthy Harper and Ethan into
the
like,
club.
This is how it works, you know? And
right.
And I feel
And
at that dinner scene, when Cameron gives that toast, like that is genuine. It sounds like, I think they all had a nice time kind of
at the end of the day.
Yeah. Which is so psychotic when you watch the last episode. It's so funny. Cause like, I remember shooting that, of course, and thinking like, obviously we were playing to the tension and stuff, but I hadn't seen the scene where they fight in the water or any of that. And so, of course, I had read it in the script, but like watching that and then seeing that scene after that, there was a huge juxtaposition that I thought was really effective. But yeah, that was, I think he does mean it.
I've got to say, I think, I don't know how online you are or how much you've seen the reception of your character and how people are fully obsessed with Daphne. To the point where she's almost like aspirational in terms of everyone else is having the worst vacation of their entire lives, but everyone online is clocking. Like Daphne is just grinning through it. Everyone's saying, I need her meds. I need her therapist. Are you paying attention to sort of like the online discourse? And do you think that Daphne is kind of the most aspirational person on the show? You know?
So I don't have Twitter or TikTok, but so I only really see what my friends send me, and it just cracks me up. I mean, some of the stuff is so funny, and I guess watching the show, I do understand why she might be that character, because she just has the sunniest disposition maybe out of any of the other characters. And I think that just because of that, especially because her storyline is like what it is, it's like, you know, one of the more sordid, you know, stories. And then for her to be in the face of all of that, be as sunshiny as she is, I totally get why that would be a character that people were like, I want to be her. Everything bad happens to her and she doesn't care about any of it.
Well, because she takes that bad and then does her own thing and sort of balances the karmic scales or whatever, however she looks at it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've mentioned in some interviews that like the bold type was like kind of, you know, a big thing in your 20s, and now the White Lotus arrived in your 30s. And do you feel like there was growth when you were making this season? Like, how is it kind of both as an actor, obviously, but as a person to be in Sicily for these months?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it sort of goes hand in hand, right? I've never had an experience of living in another country for that long before. And I think you just, when you travel, you learn so much about the world and other people and how they do things. And then to have that coupled with working with some of the best actors in the biz. The biz? Yeah. Who just said the biz?
You did, and we love it.
I mean, I kind of said it as a joke, but like still it sounded weird coming out of my mouth. anyway, I meant it. You know, they're some of the most talented people that you could dream of working with. And so it really was a very surreal experience. And I feel like I learned so much. You know, I would sit at the monitor whenever I could and watch Jennifer do her scenes and watch Marie and Michael do their scenes. And, you know, my friends, too, I would watch Haley and Adam and Leo. And I just was so excited about what everyone else was doing that it was such an enriching experience, sort of just top to bottom.
Is there one of the plot lines that you wish Daphne could have insisted her way into, you know?
Listen, I would have loved to have seen Daphne with the gays Palermo. I mean, send her to the party. You know what I'm saying?
Get her to the function.
Get her in on that Coke bowl.
She would have the time of her absolute life.
I think she would have been such a blast there.
She would have been talked into buying a villa in Noto, and then that would be a whole thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh my goodness. You're a musical theater person, so, and you have an amazing voice, so I think you'll understand this. There's something about Daphne and the character. I think something why I connected to Daphne so much is she really has a lot of Baker's Wife energy to me in Into the Woods. And that's a role that I would really love to see you play. And like Aubrey Plaza's The Witch, that could, like, I totally see it.
Oh, there's, my God, that's so funny.
So this is my petition to, let's get you in. Let's get
I'm
you
down.
To be the
let's
Baker's Wife.
I love it.
So we're talking about kind of the intricacies of how this character was drawn, both by you and by Mike White in the scripts. But I'm kind of curious, like, what is White like to work with as a director? I mean, is he letting you have kind of free reign of finding this character, or are there really intense conversations about her arc throughout the process?
He is an incredible mixture of being very specific and knowing exactly what he wants, and also letting you do whatever you want. Like, we didn't have a ton of conversations beforehand. He's not super precious with like backstory and all of those typical actory things. He's just like, just go for it. So, you know, he would give really, really good notes, I think is what made him so great, because he created an environment that felt very loose and fun and not stressful or heavy or, you know, like pressure. But he also was really supportive. So like, you never felt like you were flailing. Like, he was always there to say like, yes, it's that, or like, try it this way, or like, I don't think it's this, I think it's that. And I just feel like everybody sort of benefited from his ability to sort of create that space for us where we weren't afraid to try something, but we always knew that he was going to keep us on the right track.
A lot of Daphne and Cameron and Ethan Harper's, what happened between them, a lot of it is left ambiguous to the audience. I wonder, was it ambiguous for you? Like, do you know what really happened with Daphne and Ethan on the island, or whether or not Harper and Cameron?
So last night at the watch party, we were watching the show and eating pizza, and about three quarters of the way through, there was a knock on the door, and we all turned around, and it was Mike White and Jennifer Coolidge walked into our watch party to surprise us.
Oh my God.
And we were so excited to see them. And it was the best surprise ever. But I even asked him later that night, I was like, so what do you think happened on the island? I was like, you know, and I gave him like two scenarios. I was like, do you think this happened or this happened? He was like, ew, I don't like to think about that.
Really?
Yeah. I think that...
Wow.
I think that he really likes to leave it up to the audience to decide. I don't think that he wants to like teach the audience anything. I think he just wants to ask a question and then give them the space to kind of like make of it what feels right to them.
Which I think goes back to Daphne's speech to Ethan about, you know, you never really 100% know another person. Like, there's always a mystery and ambiguity, you know?
I mean, by the way, that's the truest thing ever. I mean, I remember reading that before we shot it and thinking, like, how gorgeous that was as a sentiment, because it's true. And I think sometimes when we think about love and stuff, traditionally we feel like it's full access to a person. Mm. But that's not necessarily true. And you can love someone without knowing everything about them, you know? Mm. So I love that speech. I think that's such a beautiful moment of writing.
Similarly, there was some doubt online. I don't know if anyone sent this to you, but like, people were wondering, like, are those kids both Cameron's, or is like, I guess we're not supposed to know. Is that another point you think we're supposed to wonder about? Was that like a deliberate thing with her showing the photo on her phone?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think she's certainly hinting towards the fact that her son might not be her husband's son. Mm. Wow. Yeah.
Which is a bit of power in a weird way to have over Cameron, you know, in some ways.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's pretty unhinged if you think about it. And again, I can't say with 100% certainty either, because I don't know myself, but I think what I can say is that that's certainly a very real implication. Mm.
It's funny just that the moral journey of this season and these characters in particular is like, well, if it works for them, that's what I've arrived at. Like, no judgments.
Totally, yeah. Totally. Whatever works for you is the whole point of the whole thing, you know?
Wow. And now there's, season three is announced. Do you think there's any chance we'll see Daphne on, you know, at a new White Lotus, you know, maybe with Cameron, maybe not?
she does say next year in the Maldives.
Next year in the Maldives.
Yeah, so. Oh, yeah. Listen, I would be, you know, a bartender in season three. I really would. And I guess technically because she didn't die, there's a chance. But I mean, you know, Mike is five steps ahead of everyone else, and there's a chance that he'll do something completely unexpected for season three, and that will be amazing. I mean, I don't know. Who knows what's going to happen? Nobody.
Well, I suspect great things will happen for you, yeah. Because it's just really an amazing turn.
Incredible.
And such
work.
A well-drawn character, and it's been really exciting to watch you all these seven episodes.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's really incredible. Really incredible. It's so, thank you so much for chatting with us. And I'm serious about the Baker's Wife and Into the Woods.
You'd be I am obsessed with that reference.
You'd be
I totally see it.
Moral relativism.
Totally see it.
Summer 2024, yeah. We'll see you at the Delacorte.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
Well, thanks again for your time, Megan. We really appreciate it. Still watching. We'll be back in just a moment. And when we return, our poor Tanya Postboy.
Yeah. An elegy for Tanya.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's five policemen outside and two policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So I think you could look at the ending for the DiGrasso family as also optimistic.
I was going to say bleak as hell, but...
Well, I mean, I think it's optimistic until that last scene at the airport.
Yes.
Where you realize, especially with Dominic, that like, oh dear, he's saying these things. Well, Albie is saying these things to his wife on his behalf.
Yeah. Shady.
But he's still caught in an addiction, maybe. I mean, look, Bert and Albie look at this hot girl in the airport, too.
All three of the generations look at the hot girl.
There's more of a sort of like, oh, God, in Dominic's eyes. He's like, well, I can't help myself, you know.
Well, because we think that maybe, again, we talked about change with Michael Imperioli. Can people change if people want to change and how difficult that can be? And at the end of the season, I mean, his storyline basically became wanting to get his wife back, right? And doing whatever he could to get his wife back. He
right.
says goodbye to Lucia, goodbye to Mia. They go back to their ancestral town in Sicily, but it's really about getting back to his wife. And we see him, you know, crying over a photo of her. It must be noted, Laura Dern was not in that photo. She just did like a voiceover, you
right,
know, as
right.
the wife. And then so that should be noted. But you're thinking, even if he's going about getting back with his wife in sort of a really shady and not very fair manner by bribing his son with 50,000 euros to talk to her on his behalf. There's slight hope, I think, that maybe the family will be happy and he's learned his lesson until he looks at that woman that walks by. And it's all like, oh, it's a men are pigs. Sorry to be so reductive, but it's like, that's what I thought.
Maybe the hope then comes in the form of Albie. So this third generation is maybe slightly breaking the cycle because, yes, he was, you know, tricked by Lucia. But he doesn't seem that broken up about it.
Yeah.
What does it really mean to him? It's his dad's money. His dad has plenty of money. He knows, well, at least I think he hopes and trusts, as we do at the very end of the episode, that, like, that money will go to a good cause in a way. You know,
yeah,
she needs
Lucia is a good cause. She's a good person.
Yeah. And then he kind of reconnects with Portia at the airport.
Yeah.
As if to start over, as if to reset the clock. Now that they've been through these two sort of crucibles together, one that was imagined danger, the one that was actual real danger, it seems. And they've looked at life from both sides now, as a great poet once said.
Yes,
and I think they have decided, like, you know what? I think we're just going to be kind of basic people who aren't actually looking for wounded birds in Albie's case,
or the most exciting,
exactly
the most exciting person in the world. I mean, truly. And we did see this coming. We should give ourselves credit for when we did get things right. I mean, you got to get Albie a scarf and put him in Rent because he is a mark, honey. Like, it was so so funny how he got played, and he just admitted it. And I think he sort of always knew that that was a possibility, I guess, in the back of his mind. But he got swept away in the fantasy, sort of as Bert gets swept away in the fantasy of, you know, imagining his return to his ancestral home. And Lucia and Alessio, and I love that this choice for Mike White, Alessio also is a service worker who works at, we see that he's sort of standing outside another hotel wearing a name tag at the end when Lucia, like, blows him a kiss and walks off into the sunset with Mia. So sort of, I think, showing growth, or not even growth, but in a very much turn away from the first season, the marginalized, the underclass, if you will, sort of wins the day here. Like, and the rich people, at least in the DeGrasso scenario, they're the ones that get duped. They're the ones that get played. Dominic, Albie, even Bert to some degree, and Mia Lucia and Alessio, you know, the service workers, you know. The
piano player gets a little fucked over.
Okay, but he does get absolutely fucked
over. But even the story with Valentina and Mia, which I thought was a little underdeveloped, but nothing bad happens there.
No.
But Valentina doesn't lose her job for sleeping in one of the rooms. Basically, Mia's like, well, you know, I'll hang out with you tonight, but, like, you know,
let me
take you to some lesbian bars and whatever, some real wild places. And that's like, okay, good. You know, and I think that Albie is sort of like, well, I was softly scammed. Like,
I
had a nice time. I think that Lucia genuinely did like him.
I do too. And I think she, Simona Tabasco, did a wonderful job of conveying that, like, I'm taking the money, but I had a nice, I like the kid.
He's a nice kid.
Nice kid.
And so everyone wins in a way.
Yeah.
At least in the moment. And, I think that ending on that note of optimism with Mia and Lucia, and a sort of winky, it was just a great closing shot, you know, and a great way to kind of conclude their story, which was exactly how we met them, kind of racing through the streets of Taormina, looking in shop windows, being like dreaming of what's to come. And they, you know, that was a really lucrative week for them.
That was a big, they got exactly what they wanted. Mia's singing at the hotel. Yeah. Lucia's got, you know, 50,000 euros in her pocket.
Open that store, maybe.
Yes, to open that store. I mean, it's kind of, you know, picturesque and beautiful and perfect. Who doesn't really get a perfect ending is Portia. I mean, she does get a happy ending in that she's alive.
Yeah. Yeah, she is alive. She was probably going to get killed by Jack.
Yeah.
Or at least that was sort of what was supposed to happen. And then
disposed of in some way that I think probably would end in her demise.
And he just couldn't do it. I think partly in a weird way, her calling him out in the car before they start, or what she thinks is Taormina, and saying, like, so you fuck your uncle. I think that sort of made Jack's shame or whatever sort of rushed to the surface, and he's like, all right, I don't want to see this girl again, but like, I also am not going to do anything.
Also thought that like he spared her life, I think, because he might have genuinely had like somewhat of a fun time. It's sort of a little bit of the Lucia situation, right? Where, yeah, Lucia took the money. Yeah, Jack was there on a job, but I think they both genuinely had, you know, a pretty good time with the other person. So rather than murdering her or kidnapping her or sending her into a situation that would be terrible, her going back to the hotel, that would have been terrible for her, he lets her go. Again, now filled with shame because he gets called out for fucking his uncle, who's not his real uncle. But I think those are sort of beautiful. Portia and Albie's storyline sort of beautifully parallel each other. You know, this sort of Romeo and Juliet of it all, star-crossed lovers to then meet at the airport after all of this tragedy has sort of befell both of them. Not that I think that they are meant to be together because of this, but I liked that they exchanged numbers at the airport.
And I think I think one thing, a side note, I think that Jack's future is pretty bleak.
Maybe the bleakest, because
I feel like the police are going to find him, and you know, whatever. But I think with Portia and Albie, like, you could read it as sort of, oh, nice. But it's also kind of it also says something about the sort of blitheness of their characters, where it's like, well, like, let's just, what if we just kind of did this thing that we were going to do a few days ago, you know, like, oh, okay. We like in Portia's case, she was surrounded by a lot of destruction and bad stuff. None of it her fault.
Yeah.
And Albie also didn't ruin anything, but they kind of did pass through other people's lives, people who were in much dire circumstances, or at least Albie thought. I mean, Lucia is in more dire circumstances than Albie is. And then at the end of it, we're just like, ah, who are we kidding? Let's just be together. And I think there is something satirical about that, too. It's sweet, but it's also like it tells you a lot about who they are, that they are able to compartmentalize like that and just kind of so quickly reset into like Portia saying, can I have your number?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm foolish or naive, but I thought it may have shown some growth on both of their parts, or specifically on Portia's part, where she had this nice guy in front of her who was clearly into her, who she threw away like the hot tamale for Jack once he showed up in the villa. And I think not that, you know, if you're not into someone, you're not into someone, but they definitely seem to genuinely have a connection at the very beginning. It's so hard to remember, you know, all those episodes ago, how, you know, there were some sparks, right? Yeah. And she did throw him away. And I think maybe she learned that, okay, maybe the most exciting, scariest, you know, hottest thing, you know, when you touch the stove, you're going to get burned, right? Yeah. And that's what happened.
She got what she wanted. It was too much. And I don't think that she wanted, like, a murder plot. But, she kept saying, I thought Sicily was going to be an adventure. And, well, turns out it was.
Yeah.
And she got kidnapped, and her boss got, well, not murdered. Well, sort of murdered by proxy in a way, or whatever.
And that
was too much. And so now it's time to go back to the white bread and just, you know, Albie's safe.
Yes, Albie's safe.
And maybe safe is okay for her.
Especially after you have something that's so scary.
Which, again, is breaking the cycle of Tanya.
Yes, which is breaking the cycle of Tanya. Yeah. And actually, you know,
I don't know if young Tanya going through that would pick someone safe like Albie. She'd probably just go after the next, you know, risky guy.
Oh, 100%.
So we should talk about Tanya. May she rest.
May she rest.
I have no sense of how old she was supposed to be, but you know, You saw this coming in the first
I did
episode, I guess.
Yeah, and then I let go of that theory because I was like, no, Mike White loves her too much. She's too much of a star.
Yeah.
But going back to the theory, it does make a lot of sense to sort of kill off Tanya. Her arc had come to its sort of natural conclusion. How much more were we going to necessarily get seeing? I mean, I would love to see Jennifer Coolidge all over the world.
Right.
But honestly, how much more storytelling potential did that arc have? I don't know.
Right. And Mike White said in the post-show recap thing that they do on HBO that, like, Tanya says in the first season, like, death is, like, the last experience I haven't had yet. So he gave her that experience.
Yeah.
And I also, you know, we should remember that in the first season, Tanya sucked.
Yeah,
She's, like, not a good person.
Yeah, she was a pretty
bad person.
Which
doesn't mean she deserved to hit her head on a boat and drown, but, like, you know, like, also I think there's a funny thing of, like, Tanya was not, I mean, she was probably right about what Quentin was up to,
mm-hmm.
but, like, She didn't know for sure, and she just left that room guns blazing.
Yeah, she was.
So she might have just murdered people who were innocent. They weren't, I don't think.
No.
But...
Well, it's so interesting, and I want to give you some credit, because you said in a previous episode that, you know, last season the death was accidental. The death, the main death of the season was ultimately an accident.
Yeah.
She slipped and fell and hit her head on a boat.
I think having Tanya murdered would have been too much.
Yeah.
And instead, it's like the most Tanya way to go out, where she's giving herself this sad little pep talk, like, I got this, you can do this, you can do this. And then just, it's so swiftly, no, you don't have this, you can't do it, because it's just, boom, boom, and then she's done. Like,
so derpy, as Mike Witt says in the after show, it's a very derpy way to go. But I do love...
But with its own poetry.
With its own poetry. And she gets her own sort of godfather moment, where she's guns blazing, shooting down all these, you know, the gays that are trying to murder her.
Right.
The meme of the century now.
These gays, they're trying to kill me.
These gays, they're trying
to
murder.
I think I saw that gif
16 times?
Yeah, like, in the first minute. And then over the course of the evening, thousands.
Yeah. No,
all
I'll definitely
fonts,
be using that.
Because I guess different TVs have different closed caption fonts. So there'll be different iterations of it going around.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I thought it was like a funny... turn for Tanya to still at the very end be like the gays, you know. She wasn't like Quentin is. She didn't even really see. She didn't even know one of their names.
She didn't know. Yeah, she said, and the other one. She didn't know one of the. And for her to not assume that the man leading the ship, like the captain, was also gay.
Right.
That was
and
hilarious.
Also in on it.
And also in and yet also a part of it because he's in charge because he's driving the boat like,
right.
because he's not fancy. Shows Tanya's delusion. And even in her last moments with Quentin, she could have asked him anything in the world. He's dying in front of her. She has just murdered this man. And all that she can think of to say is, you think Greg's cheating on me? Like,
I mean,
that's her self-delusion is so, so funny and so devastating. But it just, it gets me every time.
And like, my boyfriend asked me this. We watched it together. And he was like, wasn't there a staircase right behind her to go down to the little boat? And it's like, yes, of course there was.
Didn't
but this
the
is
man
Tanya.
Just run off the boat and jump into the water and swim away? Like, didn't she just see somebody jump into the water and survive?
Right. She could have jumped in the water, then maybe climbed onto the boat or something. But that's not how Tanya really operates. Why not? You should hours on the yacht. Call the very expensive hotel where you're a VIP client and just be like, I need a boat to come pick me up. It's that yacht out there.
Yeah, so you can see the hotel from where you are.
Yeah.
But you're that close.
Yeah.
You're anchored down. You're not, the boat's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
You're right there. But that sort of, I mean, I loved how silly it was and operatic in scale. And opera has been a big part of the season. Madame Butterfly, and we said this, you know, Madame Butterfly doesn't get out that opera alive. And Tanya becomes this figure. So the way that it was both operatic and grand, and we get this, you know, gun shooting, you know, dead gays littered across this yacht. And it seems to be a triumphant moment for her to just go kerplop. It's high and low at the same time in a brilliant way.
Yeah. And I think it's a little, I mean, it's a little bit of justice for Natasha Rothwell from the first season, you know, like not that Tanya deserved to die, of course not, but like, it was a little too easy, I think, just because of, I don't know, human empathy or something, to watch this season and be like, oh, poor Tanya. And it's like, no, but she was kind of a monster when we first met her and still was in this season, you know, sort of heedless to people and whatever.
Yeah, when she said her assistants just happened to disappear, like they become her boss and then happen to disappear. But I will stick up for Tanya in that I do think she grew. If only because she's sort of, in a way, this is maybe a bit of a stretch, but go with me here, sacrificed herself and saved Portia in a way.
That's
right?
True.
It's, you could look at it as if one of them had to go and one of them had to go, Tanya
helped break the cycle.
Helped break the cycle and
ensured that Portia wouldn't become her.
Yes.
By, you know, she's like Jesus, like in that way.
Tanya is Jesus. Yeah. Tanya is a modern day Jesus.
I think we should point out, by the way, that we had a lot of listener emails about theorizing about what would happen. Of course, when you're theorizing about a finale, most of us are going to get it wrong.
Yeah.
You and I got it wrong. A lot of emailers got it wrong. That's okay. The theories were interesting. I liked the theory that Greg was just trying to get Tanya to cheat on her to break the prenup. That was from Abby. Leslie thinks that the fortune teller was trying to like do something to protect Tanya, but Tanya cast her out of the room before the spell or what the incantation was done.
Damn.
But listener Tracy got it almost, you know, dead on. And she wrote that Tanya will somehow murder Greg and Quentin. So, okay, not Greg, but she did murder Quentin, possibly Jack, and throw herself into the sea, killing herself.
Wow.
So, Tracy, that was...
You get the Aperol Spritz, Tracy.
And then Portia can go live her life however she likes. So, Tracy, well done. Yeah, well, we wish we could email you alcohol. I don't think we're allowed to do that. But
we'll Postmates it.
Yeah. Too. So, what I liked about the ending of this season in terms of Tanya was I was rolling my eyes a little bit about this like vast conspiracy that brought her to Sicily and all that stuff. And I was like, I just don't think that's not what I thought the White Lotus was in terms of its storytelling. And, you know, it was that in some ways, but then we got the surprise, like return to Mike White comic bleakness with her death, you know, so it balanced out what I thought was maybe a little too plotty with something as silly and grim and surprising as we expect from Mike White.
Absolutely. And then also when you think about the grander show as a whole, I do think it gets balanced out by the realism and naturalism of Harper and Cameron and Ethan and Daphne, right?
Right.
That feels really grounded in, you know, real relationship dynamics. Whereas Jennifer Coolidge slipping and falling off a boat hitting her head, you know, maybe that's not the most real thing that ever happened. But did I guess? Was it thrilling? Did I see it coming? No. Did I see? I'm really honestly impressed by the capacity to be surprised, having, you know, watched the show each episode multiple times at this point. Did not for one second see Daphne and Ethan coming, which seems silly to me.
Well, we literally didn't because the camera, they cut away from.
I guess we did. We never saw it.
But yeah, no, I mean, I think that White, you know, did surprise us where it counted. And I think that making the season both pretty dark at the end, but also hopeful with the Mia Lucia thing, like, was a good way to, you know, challenge expectations, because the first season ended, I thought, pretty bleakly.
Yeah.
I mean, you could maybe make the argument that the kid rowing away and leaving his family behind was hopeful, but I thought it kind of wasn't.
Yeah.
Whereas this season was like, yeah, bad things happened and lives were changed and ruined and over, you know, ended. But like, for the most part, as you said, lessons were learned.
Mm-hmm.
Closure was found in some cases.
In some cases.
And I don't know. Maybe it sets us up for a third season. Who knows what that's going to be? We're going to talk to Mike White for an episode that's going to be up tomorrow.
Yes.
About all that. So that's it for this episode of Still Watching, but not for the season. As we said, tomorrow we'll have a special post-season bonus episode interview with Mike White to get into the making of this season of The White Lotus. After that, Still Watching will be on a bit of a holiday hiatus, but we'll be back in 2023 to discuss the next TV show of the moment. In the meantime, in our off-season, you can email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com or find me on Twitter at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S, and Chris.
And you can find me at Christress, C-H-R-I-S-T-R-E-S-S. This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our editor and producer is Dave Gonzalez, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes and Katie Rich. Our engineer is Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back tomorrow with Mike White.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.